Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back to complete our trilogy of Florida movies. Now, recently on Weird House Cinema, we looked at the movie Frogs, starring Sam Elliott, which is about as Florida as a movie can get. And then we also recently discussed the movie Zat, which is about a man who dreamed he was a catfish and then turned himself into one, though didn't really look like a catfish, but just sort of like went around settling grudges and getting revenge in semi-catfish form. And it's more Florida again. This time it's going to be Florida Nazi Zombies.
That's right. We're going to be looking at the 1977 film Shockwaves. I believe it was actually filmed in 1975. So it's still a few years later than our two previous Florida films. But it is very much a product of the 1970s. And it is, I should make it clear here, it's actually supposed to take place on a Caribbean island, but it's very much filmed in Florida. And I think it's ultimately a Florida movie to its core. It has elements in common with our previous two picks, but it's also doing its own thing.
You know, I think it's fitting that we discuss our final Florida movie today, because I have to be honest and say I am running, like, right now my gas tank is full of sand. So Rob, I hope you can bring the life to inject into this podcast today. I'm going to do my best.
All right. Well, I have my tea here, so hopefully that will invigorate me as well.
Okay.
This movie has things in common with both Zat and Frogs, but it's very much doing its own thing because, for starters, it's a zombie movie. Furthermore, it digs into two different subgenres of zombie movies by being both an aquatic zombie movie and a Nazi zombie movie. And, you know, it's pretty early in either of these subgenre traditions, and I think you could also make a strong case that this film might be the true trendsetter, if not one of the key trendsetters for both.
You know, I think I've said on this show before that of all the different types of creatures in horror movies, I feel like on average, it's zombie movies that are the most often trying to say something with the story they tell. You know, that zombies for some reason just lend themselves quite well to cultural commentary. This movie, I don't think it's trying to say anything.
No, I don't think it is. I think you can lean into, we'll discuss, you might be able to lean into it a little bit and draw maybe a little bit of nuance from it. But for the most part, this is a film that just wants to scare you and have some creepy stuff going on in it. And it ultimately succeeds.
Yeah. This is a success on the front of a stylish horror movie, in that the creatures look creepy and you spend a lot of this movie just looking at them. They're just like popping up out of the water, popping up from behind roots, kind of like, you know, you might open a drawer in the kitchen and there's one of these zombies in there and it's just looking up at you with those goggles. And that's what it does. It does it well. And I give it all credit.
Yeah. So we'll talk about the zombies in this film a bit more. Now on the zombie front, on the Nazi zombie front, rather, there are only a handful of cinematic predecessors to this movie. There was 1943's Revenge of the Zombies, which had John Carradine in it, who's also in this film. Mm-hmm. And that involved a mad scientist trying to create zombies for the Third Reich.
But wait a minute, hasn't it been proven that John Carradine is actually in all films ever made?
Just about. We'll do a proper breakdown on Carradine in a bit. But he's come up before because, he has a tremendous filmography.
Now, wait a minute. I challenge you. Name a film John Carradine was not in. You can't do it.
Within his lifetime, he was actually in some films outside of his lifetime, which we'll discuss. There was also a 1966 film called The Frozen Dead, which had thawed Nazi zombies in it. And there are a handful of other films that also involve Nazis and the occult as part of a general trend in science fiction and horror, as well as New Age and conspiracy thinking. Because the filmmakers behind Shockwaves, they're pretty upfront about citing a 1960 book titled The Morning of the Magicians as a prime influence. So this, I think we've briefly discussed this book before, talking about like ancient alien stuff before, but this was a popular book in conspiracy theory circles, remains popular in conspiracy theory circles because it entails just a whole host of their favorite topics like UFOs and Nazi occultism and so forth.
Though it's funny, we think about the occult Nazi subgenre as the special remit of sort of obscure dreck in the film world. But it's easy to forget that some of the most mainstream movies ever got into this territory. This is what Indiana Jones is about. It's all like occult Nazi stuff.
Yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark is the biggest Nazi occultist film of all time. And later on, you had Guillermo del Toro's Hellboy got into the same territory. But that was a little bit later. Initially, like Shockwaves was a big trendsetter. There was a film in 1980 called Zombie Lake that I think was a French-Spanish production that was, I think, heavily inspired by Shockwaves, if not just kind of a... very, very much followed in its footsteps, because you went on to see people like Joel Schumacher get involved in the Nazi zombie subgenre, like 2009's Blood Creek. You see it in all sorts of video games. So it's become something that sci-fi and horror has really latched onto. And I think a lot of that probably has to do with just the simple formula of taking, you know, human evil and supernatural evil and combining them, taking traditional movie villains and traditional movie monsters and combining them. And maybe if you're, you know, daring to get a little contemplative, you might say, you know, the fear of reemergence of a dreadful and destructive ideology, plus the obvious metaphor of reanimated corpses.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would be an interesting thematic resonance, though I don't think I can honestly say that this movie seems like it had that on its mind.
No. That would be an add-on if you just think too hard about Shockwaves.
Right. If you were to try to make an intellectually curious zombie Nazi movie, that would be a good direction to go with it.
Yeah. Oh, but I should mention on the aquatic zombie front, there aren't a lot of films that maybe come to mind in this category. There's 1979's Zombie from Lucio Fulci, which had a pretty tremendous scene with an underwater zombie, a shark, and I think a snorkeler. It's been a while since I've seen Zombie.
It's best remembered for the zombie fighting the shark, and I think the zombie wins. I think it like bites the shark defeats it.
Well, it is called Zombie, not Shark, so that makes sense. But that was 79.
I can't stand by that. Sorry. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's a draw. I don't know.
Okay.
But at any rate, that came after Shockwaves. Mm-hmm. A film that came before it, but just barely, was the Ghost Galleon from 1974. That was one of Amando Di Osorio's blind dead films. I don't know if you've seen any of these, Joe. They're pretty low budget, and they have a bunch of undead Templars engaging in, generally they're just chasing people down and killing them. But in this particular one, they're engaging in some beach and underwater horror.
Oh, well, so the undead Templars connects to a thing I was going to ask you about, which is, I was trying to think if there is something else like that, you know, because there are tons of these Nazi zombie movies. If there's something else like that, like a group of, like, it's all zombies, but they're united by something they had in common in life. Maybe like they are a certain type of soldier.
Yep.
And I really couldn't think of, I could think of tons of Nazi zombie movies, but couldn't really think of many other examples. So it makes me think that what's attractive about this subgenre is not that it's like, oh, they are, you know, they all have this in common and then they become undead. It's the specific historical resonances of the Nazis. And I think you're exactly right when you say it's probably as simple as what's the evilest human thing you can think of, mm-hmm. and then just make it supernatural.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And it remains a winning formula, like now more so than ever.
But anyway, the Templars thing here you cite, that would be one counterexample. Okay, here's something else. This is like, they're all Templars and now they're Templar zombies.
Yes. And maybe there's some other examples out there in the film world that I'm just not aware of. So if there's something... like maybe are there zombie samurai films? I don't know. Nothing's coming to mind, but maybe I'm missing something obvious.
Are there zombie Chicago Bears or like a specific sports team?
A zombie that sounds like it could be like a good sort of
feel
Disney
good
movie, you know, yeah. Where it's like there's nothing in the rule book that says a team of zombies can't take to the field and try to win the Super Bowl, and then it happens and it's magical for everybody.
You producers out there, we're just feeding you gold day after day.
I know, I know.
You got to send us the checks.
All right, let's get to the elevator pitch for this film. It's pretty simple. Aquatic Nazi zombies left over from World War II rise from the deep in the Caribbean to hunt down tourists through a desolated beach resort in the mid-1970s.
Yeah, with Peter Cushing.
Yes.
Peter Cushing just happens to be in the mix.
All right, let's have some of that trailer audio.
You are now in the deep end of horror. Shockwaves. Once they were almost human.
You mean to say that what we all saw out there is just a mirage?
It was a minor underwater disturbance, with a hot sky acting on a cold current coming from a mile down below.
Something unknown, something unforeseen, something unspeakable lives below, and it lives to destroy. They have risen.
All right, so who directed this thing?
This film was directed by Ken Viderhorn, director and writer. And while this was his big breakout film, he went on to direct a number of genre features, including Eyes of a Stranger, Return of the Living Dead 2, Dark Tower, which I believe is a haunted skyscraper movie. I haven't actually seen it. And he also directed 7 episodes of Freddy's Nightmares, as well as A House in the Hills.
I think I have seen Dark Tower. I think somehow I just found that on the internet one night and put it on, and it was pretty bad. Return of the Living Dead 2 I haven't seen, but Return of the Living Dead 1 is one of my favorite comedy horror movies. That mm-hmm. movie is near perfect.
Yeah, Dan O'Bannon on that one. Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, but I've heard that the second one I've heard it described as still pretty fun, but sort of taking the premise of the first movie to a kind of Looney Tunes elevation.
All right. Now, I mentioned Viderhorn was one of the writers. The co-writer on this was John Kent Harrison, who enjoyed quite a writing and directing career after this, though not a lot of stuff that I'm personally familiar with. But his credits include 1999's You Know My Name, starring Sam Elliott, as well as A Bear Named Winnie, which I think is like a Winnie the Pooh, or maybe it's a biopic about the creator of Winnie the Pooh. It starred Michael Fassbender.
As Winnie the Pooh.
Michael Fassbender was in, I think he was in a Nazi zombie movie, the one directed by Joel Schumacher, by the way.
Okay.
As well as Stephen Fry was also in that.
Wow.
Also responsible for The Courageous Heart of Irene Sindler, starring Anna Paquin. So Yeah, this guy went on to do a lot of stuff and is still active.
Did the writer of Shockwaves write Mr. Holland's Opus?
I don't think so, but that's like the sort of genre of film that he seemed to have gone on to.
Uh-huh.
All right, well, let's talk about the cast here. Top billing, and we've already mentioned him, Peter Cushing is in this. He plays SS Commander, no given name for this character. They're light on names.
Oh, that's right. He never says his name, yeah.
Yep, doesn't introduce himself.
Also, I don't think he even tries a German accent, does he? I don't recall one.
It's a little German. It's very clearly identifiable as Peter Cushing. It's Peter Cushing, like, Germaned up 10%. Basically.
Okay. Apologies for misremembering.
So Peter Cushing, of course, lived 1913 through 1994. He's a legend. This is Hammer's Dr. Frankenstein. This is Star Wars' Grand Moff Tarkin. Enthusiastic war gamer and the man with the sharpest cheekbones in the biz.
He can use multiple parts of his face as an ice pick.
Yeah. This I used to own the Blue Underground DVD of this film and somehow lost it. But I remember in the various extras on that, they talked to some of the cast members on this, and they talked about working with Peter Cushing. And like everybody else, it seems, they just had nice things to say about him. He was just like a total professional, super nice. And like I think the only even slightly negative thing is one of the actors said something to the effect of like, yeah, he showed up and he just had all his lines memorized and he was so professional that he made me feel like a little crappy for not being as on top of things as he was. But yeah, everybody seems to have loved Cushing.
That's something I'm always kind of curious about when you hear those little things about which actors memorize their lines and which ones don't.
Yeah, Cushing was, I think he was one of, yeah, he was a total pro. Like it didn't matter what caliber of film it was, he showed up and he did the job. All right. We did mention John Carradine is in this.
Yeah.
He has the distinction of playing the only character with a last name.
Really?
He plays Captain Ben Morris.
I don't say really because I am surprised nobody else had a last name. I'm surprised because I didn't remember him having one.
No, but maybe that was one of his demands. He's like, I'll do it, but you've got to give me a last name. I'm not playing a character with just a first name or no name. You leave that to Cushing.
Oh, he's kind of grizzled in this.
Yeah. This is another film legend, certainly a horror screen legend. He was in any and everything from 1930 to 1995. Yes, 7 years after his death, a little film called Jacko that I think you've seen.
Yeah, I don't even know how to describe that one. It's an Omega grade direct-to-video Halloween-themed movie that has him in scenes where he is not on screen with anybody else because I think his footage in the movie appears to have been shot approximately 17 years before the rest of the film. Otherwise, it's got like Linnea Quigley and a bunch of teenagers running around getting attacked by this thing with a pumpkin head, I think.
Okay. Sounds like a winning concept. Carradine was in a lot of indie and horror films, but we have to remember he was also in The Grapes of Wrath. He was in Stagecoach. He was in The Ten Commandments, which also featured Vincent Price, speaking of horror icons.
Yeah.
And of course, John Carradine was also notable as the patriarch of the Carradine family, the father of David, Keith, and Robert Carradine, who all carried on this tradition of being in, you know, all different sorts of films, but also doing a good job. Like Carradine John Carradine's always watchable.
I was really hoping he would sing a song in this one, though. Like, you couldn't even, so he's done the Night Train to Mundo Fine. Could he not come up with the Island of the Shock Waves? It seems like they should have put in the effort.
I either read or remember from Blue Underground DVD that he did all of his stunts in this, which don't really amount to a lot, but he was 71 years old at the time, and like he did like all the physicality that was asked of him in this. So apparently quite a trooper.
At the part when you see his dead body under the glass, as they ride a glass bottom boat over his corpse, and he's there shirtless with his hair swinging around in the water. So that's him.
Believe so.
Yeah, all right.
These guys get top billing, you know, because they're the horror icons and they're the ones you want to put on your horror poster. But the real star, like our lead and our main hero, is the character Rose, played by Brooke Adams, born 1949.
I love Brooke Adams. Brooke Adams is in one of my all-time favorite horror movies, the 1978 remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which you've never seen, is just excellent. Just one of the best ever made.
This is the Philip Kaufman one.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so at the time of Shockwave, she was an Indian TV actor, though she had appeared uncredited, I think a very bit role, in 1974 as The Great Gatsby. But her career took off after Shockwaves, maybe because of Shockwaves, I don't know. She was in Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven the following year. Uh-huh. You already mentioned Body Snatchers. She also went on to star opposite Christopher Walken in David Cronenberg's adaptation of Stephen King's The Dead Zone.
Oh, yeah.
She was in The Stuff, The Unborn, and she did a whole lot of TV work. And as a bit of trivia, she's been married to actor Tony Shalhoub since 1992.
Oh, I had no idea. Yeah, Brooke Adams is great. She's got that great screen presence, the kind of just instantly likable, always.
Yeah. Yeah, she checks off all the major boxes for female lead in a 70s horror film in this, while also like having that extra bit of charisma and talent. You know, it's not surprising that she went on to be in all these other things. You know, there's sometimes just the way she delivers certain lines in this that might otherwise be throwaway lines. She's able to inject a certain amount of nuance or comedy into it.
Yeah. Okay, so who's our mustache for the movie?
Oh, well, this is Luke Halpin playing Keith. Halpin was born in 1947. Handsome fellow with a maximum mid-70s mustache. Mm-hmm. And his main claim to fame prior to this is that he played the character Sandy Ricks, a child, in the 1963 film Flipper, opposite Chuck Connors, and then played the same role in the TV show to follow. Though in this, the TV show did not have Chuck Connors and a dolphin. It had Brian Kelly and a dolphin. Fun fact, Brian Kelly has a single executive producer credit on IMDb, and it's for Blade Runner. But anyway, Halpin's good in this. I liked him.
Yeah.
Maybe it's his mustache. I don't know.
Oh, we can call him the mustache runner from here on out. I was thinking he's very 70s. To me, he looks like one of the members of Stillwater. You know, he looks like he just lost 4 cases of beer playing cards with Humble Pie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's got a certain. He's no Sam Elliott. You know, but he has a certain laid back mid-70s style to him that works well in the film, and he's also decent at bringing across a certain level of fear and anxiety that of course becomes absolutely necessary in a film like this.
Yeah. Now the rest of the cast just sort of is rounded out mostly by these people playing tourists who are zombie fodder.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how many of them are necessarily worth spending a lot of time on, but they're all pretty good in their role. You have this guy, Fred Butch, I believe it is, lived 35 through 2012. Yeah, plays the character Chuck. This is a guy who had various roles in 80s movies, including Cocoon and Caddyshack. And he looks like he was in another Florida movie, this time a slasher titled Nightmare Beach from 1989 that Umberto Lenzi was involved in. And that also featured Michael Parks and John Saxon.
I was thinking of Chuck in this movie as Bacardi Man. I didn't know what his name was. So I just called him Bacardi Man the whole time.
Yeah, he has a signature look, often shirtless, sometimes just in tidy whities, running around on the deck of a ship. He's great because he's kind of like you always have to have your array of characters from detestable to likable or lovable, and he's nicely situated in the middle. You know, you don't really hate him, but you're not going to be that disappointed when a zombie kills him.
He also has a seemingly out of character freak out toward the end of the movie. That's pretty amusing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, but then we also have like this angry, aggressive nerd character named Norman.
Yes. Norman is great. Played by Jack Davidson, born 1936. This actor did a lot of small parts in films, including 87's The Secret of My Success, 83's Trading Places. In this, he is a used car salesman on vacation with his wife, Beverly. And, oh, man, he is not satisfied, and he will be speaking to your manager.
Yes, he exudes not satisfied with my service. That is his personality.
Yeah. Beverly is great in this, too, played by DJ Sydney, but she wasn't really in much beyond this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then there's also Dobbs. He's like Bacardi Man number two. This movie has multiple Bacardi men.
Dobbs is your straight Bacardi man, though. He is going to drink the Bacardi straight. No mixers, no ice, and he will have it for breakfast. He plays our the dive boat's alcoholic cook, and I guess like sort of general like boat guy, played by Ocala-based actor Don Stout, who lived 1923 through 2004, and even he's good in this. It's kind of a throwaway role, I guess, but he's amusing. He's this. Yeah, just this this alcoholic boat guy who you know is not going to make it far into the film, but is also not, you know, he's not hateable.
He has an interesting death scene we'll get to later on.
Yeah. In this is a small role, but there's a fisherman that shows up early on, played by the actor Clarence Thomas, who lived 34 through 2009. An actor, and according to IMDb, which again can sometimes be incorrect, but IMDb claims he was the first African-American Florida branch president of the Screen Actors Guild from 2000 to 2002. So there you go.
Now, there's one reason I know you must have wanted to do this movie, which is it has an electronic score.
Yes, as far as I'm concerned, one of the – and I think this is essential for my understanding of the Florida movie. But yeah, one of the true stars of this film is Richard Einhorn, because he is responsible for Shockwave's tremendous score. I think it's absolutely top shelf, composed and performed by contemporary classic musical composer Richard Einhorn.
So this is not an Italian-composed score, but I would say it feels Italian to me.
Yeah, it definitely has some of those vibes going on. It's it's worth noting that a lot of electronic music in the genre score world, they come from individuals who, in some cases, they were largely self-taught, or they came up playing for and working with bands. Einhorn, however, was a graduate of Columbia University, where he studied electronic music and composition under the some individuals that are apparently major names in that field of like not just popular electronic music, but like classical composition and electronic music, like Vladimir Yusachevsky and Mario Davidovsky. And Einhorn went on to compose such works as The Origin, an opera that was inspired by Charles Darwin's life and work, with lyrics by poet Catherine Barnett.
Interesting.
Another composition, Voices of Light, was inspired by the silent Joan of Arc film. And you can find this particular piece of music on Spotify and various other streaming sites.
But he also did some trash horror movies.
Yep, including ultimately several Weiderhorn movies. He did Eyes of a Stranger, as well as the influential 1981 slasher film The Prowler.
Oh, yeah. That was when we talked about when I was a guest on Movie Crush with Chuck Bryant and several of our other friends from the office. We talked about slasher movies. That one's not – I mean, there really are no slasher movies that are like really good movies, maybe Halloween or something. But but that one's just in terms of slasher style, it's got a lot going for it. It's got a very menacing-looking killer in terms of the costume, which is similar to what this movie really has going for it.
Yeah, definitely menacing-looking adversaries. Now, Einhorn also did, let's see, Blood Rage, Dead of Winter, The Dark Tower, but he also composed the scores for, in particular, the score for 1991's Closet Land. This starred Madeline Stowe and Alan Rickman, and Philip Glass was involved as creative musical supervision. And from there, he also did various work for documentaries and art films.
Hmm.
Now, interestingly, Einhorn lost his hearing at the age of 57, and there's a 2011 New York Times article that details how the use of a hearing loop allowed him to enjoy live music again. So if you're interested, I recommend looking that article up and reading it. It's quite breathtaking, because it gets into the technology a bit, but also just talking to Einhorn about how, you know, he'd lost his hearing. He thought that he'd never be able to enjoy live musical performances again. And then he was trying on this loop, and he went to see Wicked, I think, or something like that. And he said, "I'm not even a fan of musicals, but the experience reduced him to tears, you know, because he was able to hear this again." So it's a really great read.
That's inspiring.
Now, the score for Shockwaves, again, I in my opinion, I think it's absolutely great. Legitimately jarring, deeply disturbing. I think Shockwaves would have ultimately been an interesting film with a different score, but but I'm not sure it would have really succeeded to the level that it does, because Einhorn just fills the picture with sonic dread that makes everything else work 10 times as well as it would otherwise. There are bits where he bleeds in the audio of like chants from the Third Reich, and there are also some really unsettling nature sounds as well, underwater reverberations. There's this disturbing shrieking sound at one point. So the music really, really keeps you on your toes.
Let's hear some of it.
Now, I don't think the score is officially available anywhere in digital form, sadly. You may be able to find some unofficial streams, but Waxwork Records has it out on vinyl. And I'm not a vinyl collector. I do not have a record player, but this looks absolutely splendid because it's remastered and it's available in Seafoam Green. The actual record is Seafoam Green. And then it has some custom art on the front and on the back and some new liner notes. So any vinyl fans out there, if you're interested, check this out. And if you already own it, tell me what it is like.
Oh, I may have to order this one. Yeah, it has good art.
All right. I guess a couple of more connections here in passing. Alan Ormsby was born 1943. He was responsible for the special makeup we see in the picture of these Nazi zombies. And while he worked special makeup in a few films previously, including Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, he also wrote that film and actually served as a screenwriter for many years, with credits that include Paul Schrader's Cat People, the 1991 horror anthology film Popcorn, The Substitute starring Tom Berenger and its various sequels, which I think we've talked about and confused it with other films on previous episodes of Weird House.
I think on reflection, I have not actually seen that movie. I just find it conceptually funny because it's Tom Berenger looking so stern.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the main thing he does in it. But then also, Ormsby has an additional story material credit on Disney's animated version of Mulan.
Huh.
So, yeah, strange connections on this one. But yeah, the Deathcore troopers in this do look very creepy, with the goggles and the mottled pale flesh and wet seaweed-like blonde hair.
This is one of those movies that knows it has a great looking monster, and so they just show it. You know, it reminds me of the story about the production of the first Friday the 13th movie, when they had what's his name, who's doing the blood, the makeup effects?
Tom Savini
doing the makeup effects, and they realized the makeup effects looked so good, they were like, well, we got to put those more on screens. They just kind of played it up. You get the sense that's what was going on here. I suspect the zombies in this movie ended up looking creepier than the director might have hoped, and so we end up just seeing them a lot.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product, and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear.
We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, let's get into the plot breakdown for this film. Let's explore shockwaves.
Okay. Well, this is one of those movies that starts with a Texas Chainsaw Massacre style grim voiceover before you get any action or meet any of the characters.
Yeah, it wants you to know, this really happened, or to a certain extent.
The following is a true story about Nazi zombies.
Yeah, and I'll just go ahead and read it verbatim real quick.
Okay.
in a creepy voice. Shortly before the start of World War II, the German High Command began a secret investigation into the powers of the supernatural. Ancient legend told of a race of warriors who used neither weapons nor shields, and whose superhuman power came from within the earth itself. As Germany prepared for war, the SS secretly enlisted a group of scientists to create an invincible soldier. It is known that the bodies of soldiers killed in battle were returned to a secret laboratory near Koblenz, where they were used in a variety of scientific experiments. It was rumored that toward the end of the war, Allied forces met German squads that fought without weapons, killing only with their bare hands. No one knows who they were or what became of them, but one thing is certain. Of all the SS units, there was only one that the Allies never captured a single member of.
This is not a true story.
No, this is not true at all. But it does, it sets the stage, and you're going to see all the soldiers in the photo again in an altered form. And if you weren't paying attention, don't worry. Peter Cushing will come around later in the film, and he'll basically tell you everything again.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, you get a second exposition dump, which somewhat varies from the narration at the beginning, which makes you wonder if Peter Cushing is maybe lying a little bit, or I don't know. Or maybe, maybe I only perceive the differences. Anyway, so we start off with a fishing boat rescue. There are some fishermen who are out on the high seas, and they spy a small boat adrift, and they pull alongside to help, and then we get get some more narration, not by the John Larroquette style narration from the beginning, but instead from Brooke Adams. And she's lying there in the boat, and you hear her saying in voiceover, "I don't know how long that dinghy floated around with me lying in it. All I can remember was the sound of the water slapping against the side. Then I heard the engine sound getting closer. That was when I realized I was still alive." And it's Brooke Adams in the boat, delirious with terror. She is helped onto the fishing boat by the captain of the fishing boat, and she tries to tell her rescuers what happened, but she seems like she can't speak. She's just sitting there kind of catatonic. And she says in the voiceover that it's only now that she remembers. So we immediately cut to the past, and now we're on a pleasure boat, I guess. So we're not on the boat. We see, like, you know, Brooke Adams is diving around a reef with flippers and the diving mask. And she says, "It was the second day on one of those small dive boats that takes you around the islands. The engine had broken down for the second time." Yeah, immediately you notice something about the boat that I noticed too.
Yeah, small dive boat is not how I would describe this. This looks pretty big. I've been on some dive boats and they were all smaller than this.
Yeah, this is a large boat, but it is a large boat, and it is a struggling boat. We have a mm-hmm. struggle boat here, chugging around in the water as best it can, but they do communicate that this boat has seen better days. And then, no fooling around, we have Carradine. We immediately get Carradine. as often happens, so Carradine, there are like two captains of the ship, or Carradine is the captain maybe, and Stillwater Boy with the mustache is the first mate maybe, but he's mm-hmm. like steering the ship, and John Carradine just chews him out a lot. But as often happens when we first meet John Carradine in this movie, he walks on set looking and sounding like he just ate three jars of capers right before he came onto the camera. He's just briny and dyspeptic from word one.
Absolutely.
He's saying, like, "Keep it half speed. No sense putting strain on a crankshaft." And there's immediately conflicts between them, because I guess, you know, you got your old captain and you got your young captain. And old mm-hmm. captain is dressed like he's in some kind of auxiliary naval unit. This is, of course, Carradine. And young captain looks like 70s rock and roll. You know, he's been playing cards with Humble Pie, and now he's out here not taking his responsibilities seriously. And there's just some glorious chewing out that goes on. You know, John Carradine saying, "It's north, northwest, not northwest, you slob. We must have accurate navigation. The sailor's best friend." And he goes into this speech about how you can't be a good captain just by being good looking. It's his ability to navigate that makes him a good captain. Also, did you notice that? So during the boat piloting scenes, there's a problem that I notice in a lot of movies, which is an implausible amount of characters who are used to doing something talking about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're just saying back and forth to each other, "Steer 165 and keep her steady," and that kind of thing. But they're standing right next to each other. It just feels like the kind of thing that they wouldn't need to say out loud.
Yeah, like, even if this is the first day they've worked together, and yeah, even though you have the, you know, clearly the elder captain here, you know, trying to instruct the younger 70s guy.
Yeah. Now, immediately we get some spooky underwater stuff. We start seeing these shots of a sunken submarine, and it's weird because in some ways I would say this movie is, for the most part, not stylistically anything to write home about in terms of photography and all that. But there are like a select number of underwater shots and shots of the zombies that are actually very stylish and cool. And some of the underwater footage here where they capture schools of fish sort of darting around back and forth in unison, and the synchronized swimming patterns in the wreckage of this submarine we see at the bottom of the water. That's all great stuff.
Yeah, in its best moments, this film feels like a traumatic dream. You know, in the best way possible for a horror film.
But okay, so something spooky is under the water. The music lets us know, you know, as we're going around this wreckage, there's something wrong with it, something supernaturally wrong. And then something happens with the sun. Everything turns orange. This is not really explained, and I didn't really get what was going on. But suddenly there's just an orange filter on the camera.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know how much of this is me reading into it, knowing, you know, that they were high on the Morning of the Magicians when they put this together. Mm-hmm. But I think this is like some sort of a solar phenomenon, or there's some sort of like because later we keep hearing from them about how, oh, the compass isn't working anymore, you know, mm-hmm. and clearly it's had some other weird effects on their surroundings. So perhaps it's kind of, again, maybe kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre in a way. Like, that film opens up with this implied astrological disorder, and maybe here we're getting a more overt astrological disorder.
Okay, so, you know, Saturn is in retrograde or something, and that's when the zombies wake up from the bottom of the ocean. I see. So then we start meeting the other characters. We get to meet Norman and his wife Beverly, and they're arguing about whether the captain knows what he's doing. And it's great. Like, Norman decides he's going to go up and help the captain steer the boat. Norman, as I said earlier, is a cranky, aggressive nerd.
Yeah, he's a joy to watch, but yeah, he is such a complainer. Like, he just can't wait for Yelp to be invented so he can properly review this dive company.
This guy he's a terror at restaurants. He gets cashiers fired everywhere he goes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but on the way up to chew out the captain, he meets Bacardi Man, who I think his name is Chuck, who is more laid back. Bacardi Man is making a house of cards, one might say a bunker of cards. Mm. And his characteristics when we first meet him are that he's got his shirt unbuttoned several more buttons down than Norman does, so you can tell he's cooler. And he just drinks rum and chills out.
Yep, just having rum and coke and stacking cards.
And then, of course, we meet Dobbs, the cook we already talked about, who takes his Bacardi straight, unlike Chuck, who likes his with Coca-Cola. And Dobbs is sort of Coleridge's Ancient Mariner. He's got strong unhand me graybeard loon energy. Oh, and then they all meet up for dinner. And so during this dinner, you're supposed to be paying attention to the dialogue, because John Carradine and Norman get into this big blow up about, I don't know, about whether the ship is seaworthy or not, I think. But the main thing I couldn't stop paying attention to was this old school can of Kraft grated Parmesan cheese on the table, and the can looks blue. Huh. Now that product is decidedly in a green can, and I was trying to figure out, okay, were these cans blue in the 80s, or are the colors screwed up on the film?
Yeah, or I get, well, this would have been 75, so maybe they were blue in the mid-70s. Yeah.
Oh, the 70s, okay.
Or perhaps that astrological disorder, one of the things it did is it flipped the colors on the Kraft grated Parmesan cheese canister.
All your Kraft products are blue now, yeah.
Yeah. reverse polarity and also change the color of grated Parmesan canisters.
Uh-huh.
But let's get back to Norman's mutiny here.
What is Dobbs serving that with, though? He's got the grated Parmesan on the boat. Did he make Italian food?
I guess. I mean, we see his kitchen later, and it is awful looking. Like, it's just, it's got like just, it's pinups like plastered to the wall, like affixed in place with bile or something and chewing gum, and then just like junk all over the floor. And it looks like there has been some just disaster. I mean, maybe the idea is supposed to have been at that point there's been like rough seas, but I don't know. It just looks gross.
He lights the burner on his stove with old Playboys.
Yeah.
But as I was saying earlier, Norman does not like the way Carradine is running things. And I think he basically literally proposes a mutiny. Like, he talks the other, he's trying to talk the other tourists into taking over the boat.
Yeah. They're like, what? You're going to take over? He's like, no, we'll have one of these other people do it. They're idiots, but they can do it. Like, he's just awful to everybody.
He's just like, we'll have Dobbs drive the boat. and this seems to be a reaction to, quote, what happened earlier. And to some unspecified story that Dobbs allegedly told about spooky doings out on the ocean. But again, what actually happened earlier? Like, the sky turned orange, but I don't get what happened that it is they're reacting to.
Yeah, I don't know. Just sort of general Bermuda Triangle-ness occurred. You know, the sky went weird. The sun went weird. Compasses aren't working. Maybe they felt weird as well. I don't know.
You know, there's a great scene where Brooke Adams, is she supposed to be married to Bacardi Man?
No. Okay. It may not be completely clear in the early stages as we're trying to feel out these characters, but it becomes clear that, yeah, they're not married.
Oh, okay, okay. But she, after this, it's like the middle of the night, and Maximum Mustache is driving the boat, and Brooke Adams comes up to talk to him, and it's great. So it's like nighttime out on the ocean, and we find out from this conversation that he likes to be alone up here, and he doesn't know where they are. but then their little moment is interrupted because a ghost ship comes out of the dark and slams into their boat.
Yeah.
And so they argue about this. John Carradine does not believe it. He's like, oh, the ghost ship, huh? I bet you believe in fairies, too. But then they find a bunch of damage on the hull, and they shoot a flare out into the dark, and there it is. And this is a good creepy scene.
Yeah, yeah, because what's going on? Where did this ghost ship come from?
But then in the morning, all kinds of problems. In the morning, the boat is beached on a mysterious island. Captain Carradine is just gone. And so everybody has to go ashore until they can get the ship free of the shoal that it has run aground on. Oh, and then I mentioned this moment earlier, but while Norman and Beverly are being rowed ashore by Keith, they're being rowed ashore in a glass-bottom dinghy, which I've never heard of before. I mean, I've heard of glass-bottom boats, but those usually tend to be, you know, have more passengers, I think.
I guess it's because since this is supposed to be a vacation boat, they just have a glass-bottom boat on hand. Yeah. But yeah, it's effective because yeah, they're moving right along, and then there's Carradine's corpse just bobbing up against the glass.
Yeah, he's bubbling in the water. My train to Mundopine. And so anyway, on the island, Bacardi Man climbs a palm tree. He sees a building, and so they're like, okay, that's where we're going. So everybody hikes through the jungle to reach this building, which is a sort of classic Caribbean or Florida kind of Spanish opulent style.
Yeah, so I want to mention real quick, this is pretty fun, because this hotel that we visit here is very much a real place in Florida. This ruined hotel. They apparently paid something like $250 to rent the entire thing for the picture. Mm-hmm. But it was subsequently fixed back up a few years later and is known as the Biltmore Hotel. It's in Coral Gables, Florida, just outside of Miami. And you can look it up online. You can go to BiltmoreHotel.com and see it. It is it's super fancy. The story here, according to Jason Scott Deegan at Golf Pass, that's where I always go to get my shirts, my stories about sets in 70s zombie movies. Mm-hmm. It opened in the 20s and was the sort of fancy Florida destination for the likes of Al Capone and President Franklin D. Roosevelt. But then it was converted into a hospital in 1942, and it remained one all the way through 1968. And then it was just empty for more than a decade. And that was during that time, that's when they filmed Shockwaves there. But then Coral Gables had it renovated, and it opened back up in 87, entered private ownership in 1992. And I checked earlier, if you want to get a room there, it's like $268 a night or something like that. That probably changes. Don't quote me on that if you're planning to stay there. But the point is they rented the whole thing when it was a ruin for the duration of the filming for just $250. And so there are going to be some scenes in Shockwaves where they're in like some sizable hallways and you see some columns and a big fireplace in the background. It's fun because you can pause the film and then you can go grab your computer and you can look up current photos and you can see like those same places that are now super fancy and ritzy and colorful and just, you know, done up like a fancy golf course hotel. And I'm looking at that. And I'm like, oh man, how many people are walking through that? And they don't realize that Peter Cushing was here, you know? Right. This was Shockwaves.
No idea. They've never been on the Shockwaves tour. I was thinking, so, okay, if they had wanted to go a true direction then with this hotel, instead of the, SS zombies direction, they could have embraced the fact that this was where Al Capone and Franklin D. Roosevelt came. So they could have zombie, I guess, prohibition, like liquor smugglers. And then they could have, zombie members of the Civilian Conservation Corps.
I guess that doesn't zing as well, does it? But it could have changed the course. Like that's of media. That's where what we would have in video games now. It would be, zombie bootlegger video games. That would be the big craze.
That can maybe be interesting. I don't know.
Anyway, in this film, though, yeah, the place looks is just an effective Florida ruin. And I think it's one of the things that makes that helps make the movie work is that this is like the ruined splendor of Florida, which you inevitably encounter, examples of. You know, you can't have, coastal tourism exist in a place without things falling into disrepair and becoming kind of, mysterious or half mysterious ruins.
Yeah, so it's a good setting. And I would say this moment is also where the movie shifts gears and it goes into what it remains actually for the remainder of the movie mostly, which is shots of zombies looming, goggle zombies. Mm-hmm. Again, there's excellent costume and makeup design because it's pretty simple. They're just in these old uniforms and they've got kind of messed up looking skin. And then they have these goggles and the goggles are just bottomless pits. It's really good.
Yeah, it all comes together to make a very evocative adversary here. And at first, they just seem to be scouting things out. Like they've clearly been awakened, and now they're scoping out the joint.
So meanwhile, our tourists wander through the old hotel. Bacardi Man and Dobbs, who is also swigging Bacardi, they find a tank full of fish. I mean, are these frog fish? Like your checklist for Florida movies, it has tanks of fish in it.
Yeah, I'm not sure offhand what this was. Maybe scorpion fish, but either way, it's got some big zat energy going on, and I love it.
Yeah.
And Dobbs, it becomes clear, has this never-ending supply of booze on his person. He pulls out the largest flask I've ever seen in some of these scenes. Like, it's not a hip flask, it's like a leg flask.
It's like a backpack flask.
Yeah.
But also at this point, it's Cushing time. So they're wandering around. Oh, well, I think they somehow come across there's like an old phonograph that starts playing warped, creepy music. And everybody comes and finds that thing. And they're standing in this big hallway. And then from out of somewhere, you get Cushing voice, kind of nasal Cushing voice, disembodied, eternal, saying, "Why have you come to this place?" And they say, "Where are you?" And he says, "I am near, but also far."
But alone.
Yeah. And so from this conversation, let's see, they explain how they got here. Cushing tells them he can't help them. They explain the ghost ship that rammed their boat. Actually, it is a long wrecked ship that's out on the reef. And then this was pretty funny. Cushing just freaks out at this news. And then you see him and he learns the name of the ship and he just sort of busts out running through the forest to go look at it.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of an interesting twist on what you might expect in a lot of these films where, and not too big of a twist. I guess there's always this idea that the mastermind or the mad scientist involved in a scenario is going to be consumed by his own creations. But there's never even any idea, a pretense that he has control over these things. Like,
no.
He's afraid of them as everyone else from the get-go. He just has a little more information.
Right, exactly. So he goes out there to look at them. He clearly is shaken. Meanwhile, the tourists establish camp within Hotel SS. They just go into a room and they start getting pillows and mattresses.
Yeah, might as well get comfy.
Yeah, they get comfy. And and then there's this great shot. Again, most of what's the best about this movie is just good, creepy shots of zombies in goggles doing creepy stuff. One of my favorites is this moment that's coming right up where the zombies have like these little cubicles of coral that they appear to be sleeping in. They're like laying down horizontally in these little boxes around the reef. And there's one scene where one of them reaches up from below the water and grips the part of the reef that protrudes. It's very cool.
Yeah. So again, this is one of those scenes like imagery from a dark dream.
Yeah.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
But anyway, we're 40 minutes in, and I think we've just officially reached the zombie attack part of the movie, and that defines the rest of what goes on. There's two main things that happen from here on out. It's zombies being creepy, looming, looking at you with the goggles, and zombies grabbing people and killing them.
Yeah, and it's pretty effective because you have basically two locations. Three, I guess. There's the surf and out in the water. There's the sort of Florida coastal jungle, and then there are the ruins of the hotel. And in all of those, the Death Corps troopers here, they move around in very interesting ways. They're not like shambling zombies. They're very deliberate and. Yeah. And slow and stealthy, like when they stalk and hunt their prey in this, and it's very unsettling.
There is a moment where the cook Dobbs, he goes out to get supplies to cook food for everybody. I don't know what he plans to cook it on, but he does that, and I guess he's coming back with food supplies from the boat, and he gets attacked by a goggle beast. But the attack is interesting. In the goggle beast does not grab him. Instead, it menaces him until he falls to his death in a pool of sea urchins. And I think that is a first and only for me. I don't think I've ever seen pit of sea urchins otherwise used as a murder weapon in a movie.
I winced when I saw this. It's been a while since I've seen it, so I'd forgotten about this scene. But I've certainly have been around sea urchins, sometimes when I'm in the water with them. And yeah, you have that in the back of your head. I don't want to touch that. I certainly don't want to fall on it with my face like Dobbs does. So this one gave me the all overs.
Yeah. Oh, and then it's funny, everybody discovers that Dobbs has died when Brooke Adams puts on the bathing suit and decides to go swimming in this fetid pond full of sea urchins.
Yeah. Well, it's hot. It's hot out there.
Yeah. But she literally bumps right into him. So he's all mangled laying there in the reeds, and she backstrokes into him and then freaks out. Whoops.
This movie has more finding of drowned characters than any other film I've seen. But it's very well done. Like, each discovery is horrific. And even though, like, all the kills in this film are bloodless, but they're still, they tend to be disturbing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're disturbing because of the atmosphere, the music, the goggles and all that. It's, you don't need blood to be disturbing. In fact, I was actually just talking about this with Rachel not too long ago about how, when you go back and watch Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it's surprising how little blood there is in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So it's definitely similar energy in this.
But there's even less in this than there is in that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so everybody goes back to the hotel. And in the meantime, I don't know what to make of this. Suddenly they go back to the hotel and there's stuff there that I don't remember seeing the previous time, which is that, like, Cushing has, like, swastika crap hanging up. He's like he's put up Nazi decorations since they were last in his area. Is that what we're supposed to understand?
I thought it was maybe just a section of this big hotel that we hadn't seen yet.
Yeah,
he has it decorated with a billion mirrors, which, yes. I don't know, maybe that's some sort of anxiety about things creeping up on him, like his own creations here. And then he has the Nazi flags up. But this is all we see of his life here. There's no mad science lab or anything. There's no even an inclination that he's been up to anything the past, ever since the end of the Second World War. He's just been hanging out here in this ruined hotel, just doing nothing.
What's he eating? What's he surviving on?
I don't know. He's not doing great, though. I mean, he looks really shabby in this.
Yes, he does.
I don't think I've ever seen Peter Cushing in short sleeves before, but he's got these raggedy short sleeves and a kerchief tied around his neck. I mean, he looks shipwrecked the whole time.
That's a good point. I did not notice the Cushing short sleeves, but you're right, and that is a defining. I mean, Cushing is somebody who needs a jacket and tie.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of who he is.
Yeah.
But here we get our exposition dump. Should we have exposition dump music that plays every time we get to that part of the plot? I don't know. Seth, I'll let you decide that. Anyway, but exposition dump, Cushing is now explains everything to them. He's hanging out with Norman and Chuck and these goobers. And
he's very succinct, though. Like, he doesn't mess around. There's no gloating. He just tells it like it seems to be.
No, here are the facts from his exposition dump. It is, you are dumb. You should have left. Now you will die. Allow me to explain. I was an SS commander in World War II. I commanded a group of aquatic zombie SS troops that could live underwater without ever having to surface. And then there was one part I wanted to quote because it was so weird. He says, "We created the perfect soldier from street hoodlums and thugs and a good number of pathological murderers and sadists. We called them the Toten Corps, the Death Corps. Creatures more horrible than any you can imagine, not dead, not alive, but somewhere in between." And then he starts complaining about how they wouldn't obey orders and couldn't be controlled. But he says they made them. They just, like, tried to get pathological murderers and sadists. And then he starts complaining about how they would not obey orders and could not be controlled. And at the end of the war, Cushing came to this island, I guess, to escape justice. And he sank the ship containing the Death Corps. And somehow in the past couple days, the ship unsank and the Death Corps are now on the loose. Oh, and he pulls out his Luger and he says, "Now I want you to leave. If I see any of you at all, I will shoot on sight."
Yep. And they're like, "Okay, fair enough. Gotcha." Yeah.
So then Cushing, he starts running around. I couldn't quite understand what it was he was trying to do at this point, but he goes out wading in the water. And then did you understand what he was trying to do at this point?
Yeah. So my read on this, and it could be incorrect, is that I think ultimately that he was trying to distract them. trying to distract the Death Corps. Because even though he's like, you guys are dumb, I told you how to get away and you didn't, and now you're just going to die, like all of us are going to die. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of lines where he admits some level of responsibility for all the deaths that have occurred because of these things.
Yeah.
And so there's kind of a sense, but not like a super like hammy sense, but there's this, I kind of got a sense that he was trying to distract them because he's like calling to the Death Corps and he knows he can't control them. So the only alternative seems to be that he wants to distract them away from the others so that they can possibly escape and live.
It's harder to buy him as remorseful given that he's still hanging up swastika flags where he lives.
Yeah, he's not like, I'm not saying he's not a character you feel for.
Yeah.
But that's the only thing that makes any sense within the context of the plot, you know, because I otherwise, yeah, I can't think of anything else. So listeners, if you've seen the film and you have an answer to this, let us know. But I think that's what they were going for.
Yeah. Well, eventually, so he's running around all over the place. And at some point he stops and lays down next to a pond to drink some stagnant Giardia water. And a zombie just reaches up out of the water, pulls him in, drowns him.
Yeah. Good scene. Good scene.
End of Cushing.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the tourists are trying to escape on a boat that Peter Cushing has told them about. It's just like a little rowboat. And there was a really funny scene of Norman, the aggressive, angry nerd, carrying around his suitcases while he's trying to get in the boat.
Yeah, he still has all of his baggage. He's ready to climb on this tiny boat with several other people. And of course, they call him on it. They're like, what are you doing?
I know several of us have died, but I still have 5 suitcases I need to bring with us.
Yeah. And then when they tell him he can't bring them, he like throws a mini tantrum. He's kind of like, oh, fine. Like, I'm mad. I'm mad. Don't get to keep my suitcase.
One of the bags he's bringing with him looks like it's a folding, one of those bags you transport suits in. You know, so he's got like formal wear with him.
Yeah.
He's going to need that tuxedo after they escape.
Yeah.
So anyway, they're trying to escape on a tiny rowboat. This part I thought had some pretty cool shots of them like paddling around through these mazes of mangrove roots while the goggle boys are lurking beneath and all around spying on them. This part I thought was creepy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, but then it just turns into a parade of errors, mishap after mishap. They run into a mud bank. They have to try to run the boat out of it. Beverly falls out. People go after her. Rose gets knocked out of the boat. That Rose is Brooke Adams. And then eventually, after a bunch of screwing around, the boat floats away under sail with no passengers. Whoops.
Yeah, so now they've really failed. Well, they failed for the second time here because now there's nothing they can do but run back to the hotel.
Right. So there are various chases now. Everybody's running around in different places. Norman gets attacked in the water and killed. Bye-bye, Norman. Brooke Adams gets chased, but there's a cool moment where she manages to kill one of the zombies by knocking its goggles off. Here again, do you understand what was going on here? So the goggles come off and then somehow its face like rapidly rots.
I think it's like they're susceptible to the light. Like if the light gets in the sunlight gets in their eyes, it destroys them. And, you know, we were also told that they draw their energy from the earth itself. So I think that's one of the reasons, I guess, that we have all those scenes of them like in the water, walking along on the bottom of the seafloor, like it's nothing, like they have some sort of supernatural connection to the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of warped pagan magic that was co-opted by the baddies.
Okay, that would make sense. Anyway, meanwhile, back at the hotel, so the remaining tourists, Chuck, Keith, Beverly, and Rose, they decide to hole up in a refrigerator overnight by locking the door, hiding in there. We get to watch the zombies.
A big walk-in. Not like your refrigerator in your house. But a big one, a big walk-in freezer thing.
And it doesn't have power, so it's not like cold in there. Mm. We get to watch the zombies wrecking the hotel. They're just like smashing mirrors and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then inside the fridge, this is the moment I mentioned where Chuck has this kind of out of character freak out. He just starts ranting and screaming and hyperventilating. He's saying, "Let me out. I'll take my chances." Maybe he's claustrophobic or something.
I guess so. Yeah.
But it's revealed he's got a flare gun. He starts pointing the flare gun at people, and he accidentally shoots it. I think this blinds Beverly. And it's during the scene where they like all have to run out of the refrigerator because Chuck has shot this flare gun inside it that I noticed finally that Keith is wearing bell bottoms. And I suppose he has been the entire movie.
Oh, but of course he has. Makes perfect sense.
So then we're into endgame, basically. Like, Chuck is running around. He's showing off his muscles, and he's trying to fight back against the zombies, but he falls into a pool, and he gets killed by zombies.
Yeah, he effectively clotheslines one of them, yeah. But then they get him. And that pool death scene is pretty horrifying. Now, again, the sort of vacation world ruins of this place.
Yeah. Keith and Rose actually successfully hide till morning, I think, inside a furnace. They mm-hmm. like open this metal grate and hide in there. And then in the morning when they come out, they find Beverly dead in a fish tank.
Yep.
And they find Chuck dead in a pool. So then it's just to escape mode. It's, you know, they're trying to escape in a boat. Keith doesn't do so well either. He gets dragged out of the boat multiple times. And eventually we get yet another sighting of a corpse through the glass bottom. And it is only Brooke Adams who makes it out. But even does she really? Like the other Florida movies we've watched, this one has a downer ending where really nobody wins.
Yeah, a real gut punch of an ending because, first of all, everyone except Rose has been murdered by the Death Corps. Like, mm-hmm. everybody. Except the fisherman and his son at the beginning. They're good.
Oh, yeah, they're doing okay.
Yeah, they're doing all right. But everybody else dead. And even though she survives being adrift at sea for days without water, she's obviously left terribly traumatized. And the account that she's been writing down in her journal, there's this really awesome scene there at the end where the camera pans around and we see that she's been writing. We assume she's writing the narration. She's writing her story, but then we see that her journal is filled with nothing but nonsensical scribbles. So you have this very classic weird horror ending as our protagonist has survived physically, but not mentally from a brush with supernatural horror.
This is actually extremely close to the ending of Zat, where it seems like all of the human characters who are not catfishified mm-hmm. are either dead or there's one who was apparently saved but now just wants to march into the ocean.
Yeah, though I guess the thing is that at least you feel good for Dr. Leopold because it's like, well, Dr. Leopold won. He got what he wanted and I guess it's good for the fish.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But in this, like, nobody really wins. Like, I guess the Death Corps wins, but they don't really want things. They just murder, you know? So it's kind of a nihilistic ending, but feels, you know, honestly 1970s. You know, it's kind of it also reminds us a little bit of Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
yeah.
where in that, our final girl gets away, but she's like laughing maniacally. There's a sense that perhaps she has not survived completely, survived physically, but not, mentally or emotionally.
Oh, well, I guess you could read it that way. But then again, I don't know. I can scarcely think of a movie ending where the protagonist escaping danger is as cathartic and feels as rewarding as the end of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
True, yeah.
Like, when she gets into the truck and gets away at the end of TCM, like, that is probably, like, the biggest, like, just absolutely visceral in-the-body sense of relief I can think of in any movie I've ever seen.
You're right. It does feel like a victory at the end of TCM. Like, she has gotten away. Leatherface is defeated and gets it. In this, though, yeah, the baddies, for the most part, didn't get it. And she's in kind of a sad state. So, yeah, it's, a gut punch of an ending, but one that feels... on message for this film.
But we don't get to see the Death Corps doing chainsaw ballet on the beach like we do with the Leatherface. Yeah.
All right, so Florida movie checklist. We had Florida ruins. We had oppressive Florida wilderness. We had mm-hmm. marine life in tanks. We had electronic music. And we had a dark ending. So really the only things we're lacking that were present in previous movies are, well, I was going to say shots of animals in the wild, but we do have some fish scenes early on. So mm-hmm.
sea urchins.
Sea urchins are in there. Just maybe not as much wildlife as we saw in Frogs, certainly, or in Zat. And also we don't have an ecological message.
That's true. This one, those two movies, both, even if it was maybe not super well articulated, they've got an ecological message. I don't think this movie really has any message at all.
Yeah.
None that is intended. If it is, it's just like, don't create a Death Corps. No, do not screw around with making undead superhuman Nazi soldiers.
Yeah, or properly research your scuba outlets before you can go on a vacation. I don't know. But this one I think is pretty effective. I remember seeing, I think I saw the last maybe 30% of it on TBS or TNT back in the day, like saw it during the day at my grandparents' house and was really creeped out at, by it. And it's actually a great horror movie to have seen during the day because most of the action takes place in the day. Like it makes daytime in Florida horrifying, you know, effectively horrifying. It doesn't have to be dark in Florida for you to be afraid.
Actually, this violates a lot of rules about movie monsters. Usually, I think movie monsters are better when seen less, when kept in the dark more. You know, following the Jaws rule, like if you're going to finally see the monster, you want to wait towards the end of the movie to do it. This movie, no, is just putting its monsters front and center, tons of screen time, showing you all the time, much like Zat, actually, but very different from Zat. The monsters look very menacing in this, and it actually works better when you see a ton of them.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, there's one scene in particular where I think we've effectively killed one of them at this point. Mm-hmm. You pull the goggles off, and then we still see there's so many. And I mean, chalk it up to a good film. I was when that happened in my recent reviewing of it, I was like, oh my goodness! Like I felt my heart sink. There were so many of them, even though I knew what was going to happen.
I wonder what those goggles actually were. Were they like welding goggles? What do you think that was they were wearing?
I don't know. They look familiar, but I don't know where I've seen them before. But but good find, costuming department on that.
Yeah. Good job.
All right. So you're probably wondering, where can I see Shockwaves? Well, I mentioned that I used to own it on Blue Underground, on DVD from Blue Underground, and I think it's on Blu-ray from Blue Underground as well. I misplaced it over the years, but it's really good. It's got a lot of good extras. It's a great restoration of the film, I think, to a certain degree. There's a certain 70s graininess to this film that I think is essential. Like I wouldn't want to see it in too fine a quality. You know, it needs that 70s-ness to it. But yeah, the Blue Underground edition is nice, has some fun extras. You can also rent it digitally, buy it digitally most places. And if you want, if you want to find like a sort of a loophole to get it, I have noticed that if you do a free trial of the Full Moon Entertainment channel, like you can get through like Amazon Prime, you know, like a 7-day trial, you can watch Shockwaves through that channel.
There's a Charles Band app now.
I guess it's an app. Yeah, it's at least an Amazon Prime channel, and I think you can get it on. It's probably on like Roku and stuff like that. I'm not super versed in all that.
Okay,
but yeah, there are some ways to see this if you don't want to, you know, straight up rent or buy it or pick up that DVD. But
yeah, subscribe to BandTube.
I didn't check Tubi to see if it was on Tubi.
Oh yeah, I didn't either.
Yeah,
you know, you were talking about the look of this movie. Last thing I have to say, I realized is, the look of this movie is a blue can of Kraft grated Parmesan cheese from the 70s. That's what the aesthetic is.
Yes. All right. Well, on that note, we would love to hear from everyone out there about your memories, especially, you know, from older listeners, your memories of Kraft cheese canisters of the mid-1970s. When did it change? Why did it change? Did it change? I don't know. Have you seen this movie? Did you see it on TBS back in the day when you were a child and when were partially traumatized by it, like me? Or, you know, did you check it out later? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And just in general about other films we've done on Weird House Cinema, films you think we should cover in the future, or like a lot of our listeners, just continue to write in about Sean Connery's accent in Highland, and to what degree it makes sense and what kind of backflips we have to do mentally to have it make sense.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.